studies, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How's it going, Ironside Chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. I'm Greg Carlwood, and today we're going to talk to the man with the plan, Douglas Dietrich, making his second appearance on the show, the last one being episode 52, if anyone wants to go back and hear that one. I think it weighs in over 2 hours, but today I think we're going to talk about the idea that some of the big cultural memes of zombies are actually forms of predictive programming that may be getting us ready for real-life scripted events of a similar nature. It's a scary idea, and I don't want to be alone, and that's why I brought along my good friend and occasional co-host Kyle Prunderville. Kyle, my man, how's it going?
It's going great, man. Glad to be back on the show.
Yeah, dude, it's always a blast to have you here. Lots of crazy news was being thrown around on the internet this week. I wanted to mention one of these stories when I was talking to you in the pre-show because it's of such a positive nature. We really don't get enough positivity here on THC, and we've also talked about this kind of thing before, but it looks like Utah is actually doing something for the poor. Surprisingly, and this isn't actually from The Onion. This is like a real story. So let me read this to you from nationswell.com. Utah has reduced its rate of chronic homelessness by 78% over the past 8 years, moving 2,000 people off the street and putting the state on track to eradicate homelessness altogether by 2015. How'd they do it? The state is giving away apartments, no strings attached. In 2005, Utah calculated the annual cost of ER visits and jail stays for the average homeless person was $16,600, while the cost of providing an apartment and a social worker would be $11,000. Each participant works with a caseworker to become self-sufficient, but if they fail, they still get to keep their apartment. Other states are eager to emulate Utah's results. Wyoming has seen its homeless population more than double in the past 3 years, and it only provides shelter for 26% of them, the lowest rate in the country. Blah, blah, blah. There's no telling how far this idea might go. Isn't that some inspiring shit?
That's the ultimate shit. I mean, I feel like they've been tuning in, and they've been reading my blog, and they're onto it. I mean, there's been so many memes ever since Occupy about this concept of peopleless homes and homeless people, and in fact we have more peopleless homes than homeless people, and it just so happens I'm situated in a particular house that I live in where both of the neighbors are vacant. But the way the system is set up, people just own houses and leave them vacant, and this is a system that it's hilarious that it's actually cheaper to pay for their rent and a social worker. And in St. Louis, there's, you know, plenty of homeless. I don't even understand how they survive the cold. But in talking with them personally, they say that a lot of times they just get picked up and dropped off by the cops at a different location. Just kind of like shuffled around. And so, you know, something else they don't factor in that cost is that cops are just paid to be on the clock moving around homeless people and jailing them. And this is a sweet solution.
Well, this is so in line with Venus Project type thinking, internet. This is like an internet idea, really, to me. All those ideas of low cost and providing things to people for free, that we never had that in culture before the internet. Then it was music was free, and we're like, holy shit, like you can just get anything, any music, and then it's movies, and now we're just giving away homes.
Yeah, the internet helps connect the dots, and it helps connect the networks, and it makes, you know, it makes ideas really simple and easy to understand. It reduces them to like the easiest terms.
Right. And obviously housing, we're not torrenting housing, but the internet, I think, has led people to come to the conclusion that people have come to is that by someone else getting something, you're not losing anything. So it's a net win. We should all want everybody to have what they need. And before the internet, I just don't think that was around. It was kind of like, I'm going to get mine, dog eat dog. And that culture's still out there, but the internet culture, I think, is kind of turning the tide on that.
Yeah, it's definitely. It's more of a cooperative. It's more of a everybody's individual perspective is valued rather than shamed. And it's really cool. I feel like they efficiently use resources that we have available rather than intentionally doing really wasteful practices.
And I know I've said this to you before, and I don't know if we've talked about it on the show, but I think another idea in line with that that should happen is cities everywhere are maintaining plants and trees and flowers just for show, just in medians and on hanging off lampposts. And that should all be fruit trees and food that could be rounded up for the food pantries. And it would still look nice, you know? Some city somewhere should start that program.
Yeah, edible landscaping. I don't have the link for it, but it's one of these Facebook stories you see a little blurb of. But I heard that I think Seattle is doing a food landscaping like that, like what you're talking about. So at least there's going to be one in theory.
Oh, that's awesome. Another story I wanted to talk to you about, a little juicier one, something that you told me about that you had posted on my wall. It really got me going, is this story about Clinton, Bush, and Obama all visiting Africa in the month of June to pay homage to a new reptilian archon type being who's descended down into Africa. And people in the conspiracy world are saying it's Marduk. What do you make of this shit, man?
Well, let me just first say, the source I got this from is Veterans Today, and this is part of an article series on the Super Secret Space Project. And it just so I don't even know why. Like, it just so happens I clicked on what are the weekly top 10 articles. And this is one of the weekly top 10 articles, but this article is actually old. I think it's from like a year ago or something like that. There's at least 11 parts in this series, and this is part 3. So this thing about Marduk returning, it's really about his return, because I did some research, and he is a Babylonian god, a Babylonian head demon, the chief and strongest and most badass, you know, hierarchy of all of the Luciferian demons is Marduk.
Damn.
But Marduk is like this is kind of a cult shit. It's kind of a cult, but they say Marduk is a bit of a legend because people question, does he exist? Does he not exist? Well, we're talking about demons here anyways, but they're saying he does exist now because he has made a return. And so it is very coincidental that the two most recent ex-presidents and the current president, they're all going to Senegal, Africa. Nobody pays any attention. No big deal, but it's really intriguing, definitely. My interest was piqued.
Well, the reason I think it's cropped up recently is I tried to find other sources for that same story, and there are other websites and other conspiracy researchers that are claiming that the death of Nelson Mandela is totally fictional, that he actually died months ago, and that they've just used this time to put the news out within the American bubble or the Western bubble, because you know, people in Africa aren't going to have any fucking idea when we get the news of Nelson Mandela's death. But apparently it's providing a catalyst for more high-profile elites to visit that area. It's giving them a reason, an excuse, a convenient excuse to be there, because there's something going on with this Marduk character. He's calling in his sheep or something like that, and they all have to go there and do some, you know, blood sacrifices, the usual shit.
I want to point out one intriguing thing that he says about this and the way Marduk, this character, if he does exist, is playing this whole thing out. And maybe he's like what Jay Widener calls an archon. You know, maybe he's one of these fourth dimensional. He doesn't actually have a physical form. Or maybe you go talk to envoy of Marduk. I don't know how this shit works. I don't have black cosmic clearance or whatever. I'm not Magic 12. But perhaps Marduk issues orders and what he says goes.
Yeah, it's definitely possible. But man, the deeper you get into this weird stuff, I've also heard, also in some of those articles, they're talking about Edward Snowden currently has some information that involves Africa and some type of non-human entity. I've also heard that he's only disclosed 2% of the information he actually has. And then, of course, we have John Rappaport, who believes the whole thing's a scam anyway, which I kind of tend to believe if it's getting so much press. There's no one who doesn't know Edward Snowden's name. And to me, that's the first sign of a false story. As odd as that sounds, as backwards as that sounds. Mm-hmm. But
dude, I want to also bring up, since we're talking about the funeral, this big globally televised event, and there's Obama speaking because, you know, he's black, so, you know, black leaders got to rep each other. But who was the sign language guy, and what was going on with him? Have you researched this?
I have not researched it. I've definitely read the headlines. I've seen some small articles. Apparently, this guy is he's been accused of murder. He's a con man. He seems to be like some kind of catch me if you can type character who just fakes his way through shit. I don't know if you concur or not, but that seems to be the case. And he's apparently faking that he knows sign language. And of all places, why on earth would you think you'd get away with it at a presidential speech? Obviously, you're going to get called out. But another eerie thing is, you know, if we're so worried about the conventional idea that the president is the leader of the free world and his security is of the utmost importance, you're letting a guy who apparently forged his way in, who's been accused of murder in the past, you're letting him in arm's reach from the president. Like, there's something really weird about that. I don't think that that was an accident. I don't know what it was, but
yeah,
I don't think it was an accident.
Here's my take, and it's not really my take. A lot of people have come to the same conclusion because the story is so bizarre. Here's this guy. He's been made out, just as you said, as a con man or as a fraud. Okay, he's being scapegoated. He's being Lee Harvey Oswalded. And what was Lee Harvey Oswald? But, you know, he was the fall guy for the assassination. And this guy is very likely to be a ritualistically trauma-based mind control victim. He said that he is schizophrenic. He hears voices. He was seeing angels, he says. Angels. We're talking about Marduk and demons. This guy's talking about seeing angels. Same thing. And he is hallucinating and schizophrenic. He's within arm's reach of President Obama. There's all this confusion after the fact about how he was positioned the way he was. And some people are alluding to the fact this was a foiled, for some reason it didn't go down, assassination attempt on a very public stage. And, you know, assuming that there is a separate faction from Obama's faction that would do that to him, assuming that, it must be scary for Obama to be that close to a guy. You know, there's a lot of this going on recently with the stenographer going crazy and just shouting out stuff about Freemasons and God. And we never got the full story on what she actually said in the Congress room. Like that audio, what they quote her clip is actually from what she said in the elevator. So now there's this dude with the sign language and he's like, all these different versions of the story came out, and it was like, it's so weird. Like, what? What are you talking about?
What if that is the case, man? Crazy.
It probably is the case that this dude was a mind control victim, and his whole shady past is because he's been used his whole life.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, what if it was like a foiled attempt? Like the trigger just didn't go off, the mental trigger, and instead it was just like, he shorted out kind of publicly in front of everyone. Or maybe it was just a scare tactic to get Obama back, get his priorities back in line
for something. I mean, that's possible. And then another possibility is that it was so perfectly planned and it actually did happen. You know, they actually got him there where he was supposed to be and the stage was set. And there was some form of divine intervention that prevented that timeline. It's like preventing the reiteration of Kennedy's whole event. You know, they're doing a killing of the king ritual when they're talking about the dead former king. And
yeah, I wonder what date that happened on.
Yeah, we'll have to have Michael Tassarian back on to divine the astrological meaning of all of this.
What if it was on 12/12? That's 3/3.
I'm not sure when it was.
Yeah, it's tough to track down the exact day. Maybe it was December 10th, but man, if it would have been on December 12th, that 33 would have been really fucking symbolic. 33 on 2013. Stack those digits. Nothing did happen on that day. I don't know. Maybe this is all bullshit. But that whole Marduk thing kind of reminds me of the old Eisenhower met with aliens story, you know? He had to sneak away to go have this secret meeting with a non-human entity. Interesting fucking stuff. The world is weird, man. And it's so tough sometimes for me to entertain stories that are this crazy at this crazy of a level when the 9-to-5 reality is just so mundane. But I definitely want to cover more of them. I'd like to do more episodes about stuff like that. The wildest of the wild. And I think today is going to fit into that category pretty well.
Yeah, they say that Marduk would use kings as expendable pawns, that this is all part of his the grand play, is to have him come here at the right moment to make the United States crumble from within, make all the global powers crumble, make all global authority look totally ridiculous and fraudulent, and the people will be so anarchistic, they're going to say, overthrow everything, and then Marduk rises with the New World Order after that.
Well, at least they got a plan. So on that note, I'm going to play a little spot for the THC Money Bomb. The first one was pretty successful. Hopefully we can increase that success going forward, and then we're going to get this show on the road with Douglas Dietrich on the other side. Folks, I got to tell you about a little thing that we call the THC Money Bomb. That's when I take half the donations I get every 5 episodes and gift that back to one of the listeners. So if you can, consider donating 5 or 10 bucks to THC at thehiresidechats.com/donate. Knowing that you're helping out a show you love and with the other half helping out a random like-minded person. And hey, it could even be you. Our first THC Money Bomb got just over $500 and it was a big help to me and paid for a networking certification exam for one of our listeners. That's awesome. And I'm hoping we can have success stories like that almost once a month. Look, I love analyzing the multitude of ways we're getting fucked by the global elite, but we have to do more than just talk, and that's why with this little weekly show that comes out for free with no paywalls to the second hour, no subscription fees for the archives, and no long rambling ads, besides this one, hosted by a broke guy with a soul-crushing 9-to-5 job, has worked out a way to make a helpful financial impact in the lives of the listeners before it's even had 100 episodes. What does conspiracy mogul Alex Jones do for people? What does joining the local Zeitgeist movement chapter do for anybody? Yeah, this isn't going to change the world, but in a society where most of your money is fueling wars you don't believe in and feeding corporations that are actively undermining you and your health, you can make sure a couple of bucks a month feeds a machine that's on your side. And we might create the newest and most effective model for all podcasting monetization in the process. So ask the other shows you listen to why they don't have their own. And to keep this kosher, if you can't afford to donate even $5, then send your name and contact info to me, Greg Carlwood, at P.O. Box 635223, San Diego, California 92163. And we'll put you in the pool anyway. No donation necessary, but the more we get, the bigger impact we can have. And that's what we call the THC Money Bomb. Boom. Okay, everybody, for people who have been with me a long time, you know I don't have very many repeat guests, but I've had so many requests to have Douglas Dietrich back on the show that I couldn't just ignore them. When Douglas was first here in episode 52, he talked about his background as the man who ran the incinerator at Presidio Military Base, where he burned many secret documents at the request of his commanding officers and was also on the premises during strange rituals and the raping of children at the hands of Michael Aquino and his Satanist crew. It's a great episode if you'd like to go back into the archives and hear about the stuff Douglas has been blowing the whistle on for years, but today I brought him back to discuss some of his latest research into what's happening in the global stage now and what we should be expecting from the global elite in the coming years. Douglas, welcome back to THC.
Hi, it's great to be here. And just a little bit of qualification of what Mr. Carl was kind enough to say.
Do it.
For the sake of preventing litigation, which has already been threatened multiple times by Colonel Dr. Michael Aquino, I was present at rituals which were performed. The baby raping, however, is alleged. That is alleged by other people than myself. But what I can guarantee you is that babies were indeed raped, because that was part of the reason for the closure of the Presidio military base, which was one of the most important bases in the constellation of American bases worldwide. And
gotcha.
The United Nations is an organization of war per Title 42 of the United Nations Charter. In lieu of a constitution, they have a charter. And therefore, what I was dealing with was not just Department of Defense military records, but United Nations military records. It's very important to emphasize, because—
Fair enough.
Yeah, and beyond that, just to address the baby raping again,
please do
for a bit. Thank you. Yes, I know it's such a compelling subject. By the way, I'm not being sarcastic. This is horrible. It's a horrible subject, and the only reason that I myself often people complain about the fact that I relate these subjects with an enormous amount of detachment and callousness, and they find that highly offensive. And I do need to emphasize the fact that I have scar tissue on my soul. If I were not this detached or callous, I truly would be institutionalized at this point.
Fair.
If I don't have a extremely black sense of gallows humor and morbid chuckles every once in a while about the absurdity and the surrealism of what I speak, then yes, I would be crying and screaming the majority of the time, which apparently I do in my sleep anyway. But the point that I was making about the child daycare center at the Presidio Military Base, the person that I can definitively say was literally raping children was my high school teacher, Gary Willard Hambright, who was indicted by a federal grand jury of assaults on no less than 14 children, all of whom were under 4 years of age. He would have been indicted for many, many more had he not died of AIDS while he was on trial. Now, the end result is that apparently 500,000 children were infected with AIDS at the child daycare center, as well as infected with gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, any other number of sexually transmitted diseases. Now, simple logic and medical reality bespeaks to the fact that no matter how much of a scumbag my high school teacher was, there is simply no way that he could have, shall we say, been a carrier of all of those diseases and still remained ambulatory, let alone able to sport an erection.
Right, right.
So obviously there were many other people involved in molesting these children. Now, to clarify, the children were asked to describe their assailants, and the people that they described most often and in greatest detail were Gary Willard Hambright and Lieutenant Colonel at the time, Michael Aquino, and his wife, Lilith Sinclair. Now, again, all of these descriptions were dismissed when they were bringing the evidence that called the federal grand jury to indict my high school teacher. It was based on many other bits of evidence that would take literally a two-hour interview to go into,
right.
Extremely technical, and there's no point about going into it. The bottom line is he was indicted.
Fair, fair. We definitely covered a good amount of that in that last episode, and it is fascinating stuff. But man, I've got to ask you about some of these cultural memes that we're seeing. You know,
yes.
I mean, obviously, we all know that these mega corporations behind American media and entertainment will interject these certain memes and themes into the culture to condition us to behave a certain way. And it seems like a few of these memes are being used more than ever right now. One example being zombies. It seems like everywhere you look, Warm Bodies, Walking Dead, Call of Duty, The Last of Us, Dead Rising, Dead Island. I mean, we even have Brad Pitt starring in World War Z. And here in San Diego, they have big zombie walks around downtown every so often. I know I've wondered if there's any motivations from the global elite and why zombies are getting top billing these days, and I know you've been looking into it as well, man. Let's change gears a little bit. What do you think?
Sure, I can go into that, and let's do that. One of the first things I do want to go into is just a bit of a divergence, because it is along the lines of what we spoke, was the popularity of the movie series The Hunger Games. I honestly believe connected in a very tangential sense, but it's connected in the sense of the sense of hopelessness and starvation, of collapse, and of reconstruction in the most negative sense. It's reconstruction by a government where apparently the elites have never lost any of their grip on the world around them. Now, this is the kind of dystopia that people are being conditioned to expect, because people are being conditioned into apathy concerning the inevitable victory of the elites. One of the things that people are being mimetically conditioned for is the concept that the elites which rule us today are entirely omniscient, that they're omnipotent, that they see all, that they know all, and that they can respond to all in the most immediate sense, and with decisive action, with incredible force. And nothing could be further from the truth. The morbidly inbred elites that are in charge of our society as it exists right now, which in a very real sense is global, are basically in a spiral all the way to the bottom, like an elevator whose cables have snapped and it's heading towards the bottom of the shaft. And the destruction that they are mimetically conditioning you for is one in which they hope and pray that they can rebound from and ultimately grab back a hold of through your apathy. So the important thing, the most important thing for the listenership and for the American public, the taxpaying electorate, to realize is that if you're not apathetic, they can never do what they intend to do. And in an absolute worst case scenario, it would disintegrate. Were you that apathetic, the ultimate logical conclusion to that would not only just be the Hunger Games, but the logical extension of that would be the penultimate logical conclusion of basically H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, where the Eloi were these very passive, submissive people who were eaten by the subspeciation of humanity that had developed in their shelters beneath the ground. And that was ultimately the message of H.G. Wells' novel, The Time Machine. It's very important to remember, by the way, that H.G. Wells was an ardent communist. He was he visited the Soviet Union. He personally was interviewed by Josef Stalin, and he was very much a convert to the Soviet style of communism. He actually helped to conceptualize and design concentration camps that ultimately formed the backbone of the Gulag archipelago within the Soviet Union. Now, when he came back to Britain, he was given full hand to basically run the British media machine, and he produced what became known as The Shape of Things to Come. Now, when he produced that movie, The Shape of Things to Come, it was a cinematic flop. But the important thing to remember is, and that was what probably saved Britain from literally going Soviet. And because at that point, he had it all. He had the approval of the monarchy because he was considered an ambassador of goodwill between the Kingdom of Greater Britain and the Soviet Union. He was considered an international figure. His money, proportionately, that he was earning was beyond that of Stephen King, if you can believe that, which means he was like a multimillionaire. And then the government did something that no one has ever done for Stephen King. They gave him full sway over the media production facilities. Now, Britain is very different from the United States. A lot of people don't realize this at all. The British media machine is very state controlled. They are incredible to the point, by the way, where somebody who is reporting on the news cannot ever break that news contract and ever do acting in fictional movies because they don't want to blur the line between fiction and reality, like they do in the United States. So with that level of control the British government has, imagine them, for whatever reason, giving him full control of the media machine, full budget, full control of the music, full control of the screenwriting. No director ever has that amount of control. And he created The Shape of Things to Come. And, of course, he put it together in such a turgid manner that nobody bought it, quite literally. But the point that he was making with his time machine was that the elite would ultimately retreat into shelters under the ground, degenerate by morbid inbreeding into a race of troglodytes literally be feeding off of the Nordic, Aryan, golden people above who had grown quite diminutive from lack of conflict and quite sedate from being fed all the time because, like cattle, the Morlocks below were feeding them. And they were accepting that food. They never questioned it. And whenever the bell rang, whenever the air raid sirens would go off, they would march into the shelters to be devoured. And that is ultimately what our elite is programming you for, to be apathetic as the Eloi. And, of course, that is part of the phenomena that the Hunger Games is part of, but that's almost organic. By that I mean it's almost a spontaneous part of the cultural slide towards that direction. Now, the absurdity of the Hunger Games And what kind of, how would I say, glitches it is the fact that they're trying to portray a society that is phenomenally destitute. And, of course, you get the situation where people are starving. Now, if you ever take a look at a society where people are truly malnourished and people are starving at a regular level, you get –
not so pretty.
Well, it's beyond that. You get very few people who are capable of athletic survival. And the whole point of the Hunger Games, logically – now, by the way, it's a very good film. As a drama, it deserves its attention that it's getting as a series of what I'll call teenage girl coming-of-age films.
Right. My favorite genre.
Yeah, there you go. Up there with Crouching Tiger and Hidden Dragon. And yeah. It's about empowerment for young ladies. All of that is extremely important and should be applauded. Now, the reality of the survival part, when they're tossing them all against each other in the ripoff of Battle Royale from Japan, which is a series of manga or graphic illustrated novels that were turned into textual novels that ultimately got ripped off and turned into the Hunger Games. The whole point about these kids fighting each other is that in the Hunger Games, the theme is they're choosing them spontaneously. They literally have a lottery. And so they're choosing all these kids so randomly that the overwhelming statistical chance of them getting anyone who's capable of walking a couple of miles, let alone somebody who's capable of putting up a fight, is absurd. As a matter of fact, the whole point of the Hunger Games is that girl is their first volunteer. That is said in the film. Everybody else had been basically drafting. So they were going to draft her virginal, prepubescent, younger sister, and she volunteers to put herself in her place instead. Now, everybody, by statistical chance, would have been like her younger sister. She would have been facing a front of enemies that would have been like that. Just mm-hmm. statistically malnourished people who are cannon fodder. Now, suddenly they bring all these people in and the people are interviewed. They're interviewed before they go into before they're thrown into the pit, so to speak, into the Colosseum, into the fire, into the contest. And all of these people are attractive. They're all charismatic. They all speak without a hitch. They all are able to express themselves and even express aspirations. Now, what kind of aspiration would anyone express if they've been starving all of their lives?
Right.
Like, you know, hey, what do you want to do with your future? People are interviewing them. I mean, first thing they'd be saying is, oh, I want to eat. I hope someday I get enough strength though where I can get an erection up so there's enough, you know, so I can get laid, you know, instead of, you know, most of the time I faint when I get one because I don't, you know, I'm so malnourished, you know, or something like that.
Oh, it's my just, God. Yeah, exactly.
Then they throw them in to this kind of like training pool and they're like throwing knives, they're hitting targets, they're like, you know, and people say, oh yeah, well, you know, they've been out and hunting, they've been foraging, they've been, you know, well, okay, that would make sense if you have a cadre of people that are hunting and foraging for everybody else who's starving and they're doing this illegally as basically poaching. If they're doing all this, then the chances are the lottery's not going to pick them, but the movie makes it look as if the lottery somehow magically takes all the studs and all the Amazons out of these starvation camps and basically brings them in into a contest with each other. When in reality, if they're doing the statistical lottery bit, they would be dragging in a bunch of starving, half-dying people. And not only that, just the bizarre skills that they have. The one guy with the camouflage. I mean, I love that part. And I do have to dwell on this because he's painting himself with the camouflage. And of course, he later on becomes a talking rock and shit. And the point is that,
spoiler alert. Spoiler alert,
I'm sorry.
Douglas.
That's not a spoiler. That's not a spoiler. God, that's like, you know, you think you're flashing back to HR Puffin stuff or something. At any rate, with the talking tree, it's it. That's all. But anyhow, the point with this guy is that he's painting himself and he says, I used to be a cake maker and I used to put the frosting on cakes. Now, cake is not all that unbelievable for a starving mass of people because cake is just lard. So, you know, it'd be like Krispy Kreme's donuts. It's 100% fat content, which is what Krispy Kreme donuts are, by the way. I'm not exaggerating. They are 100% fat content. So it could be something like that, where he's just taken all the reject fat from the elite's disposals are sent over to the starvation camps, and they can make cakes so that they can fill their bellies. And by the way, that is exactly where Marie Antoinette was coming from when she was told that all of the starving masses had no bread to eat. She said, well, let them eat cake. That was what she was referencing, was the fact that it is so easy to take lard and distribute it, and she couldn't understand why the distribution system had broken down. And but then the question comes is, why is he decorating the cake? Okay, now you've got all these starving people. They're just going to eat anything.
There's a lot of plot holes in this movie, Doug. Yeah, I didn't even know this.
Yeah, but that's because a lot of Americans really aren't that familiar with starvation. I mean, one of our biggest problems in the world is overweight, right? But so when we do get to this point, and we'll come to that point, that is what your government is preparing you for. That brings us back to the zombie phenomena. That brings us back to survivalism. What is it that the government is most preparing you for, aside from apathy? You have a lot of people who I hate to mention this name, Alex Jones. A lot of these people get up on air. And what do they do every day? They tell you the government can do this. The government can do that. They can put you in concentration camps. They can take you in a train by mass and evacuate entire cities and relocate the populations. Okay, they can't even do that. They can't even pick up a phone. There's no way the government is going to be able to carry out anything. As I've said before the last time, and as Kyle and Mr. Carlwood are achingly familiar with, the one thing I keep emphasizing is that if anything gets done in our current system, it is literally by accident. I consider it literally a religious miracle that the government is even functioning. I mean, because having been in it and described what I've already described, you can listen to my last interview to get a whiff, just the tip of the iceberg of what your government is like. To give you an example of this, I put a column on my Facebook timeline about World of Warcraft. And the reason I did that is because your NSA and the FBI have dedicated, believe it or not, officially, as their objective, as their mission statement, the majority of their staff is dedicated to playing World of Warcraft. And that's official. And the whole reason for that is because they tell you that amidst all of those elves and fairy folk, there are terrorists. That all the terrorists are organizing terrorist guilds because they're disguised as orcs and succubi. And they basically get together and they communicate about all the plans of attack that they're going to make against Sears Tower and against the Trans-American Pyramid. And they disguise it all under the orchestration of attacking a boss character inside of his castle complex within World of Warcraft. And they tell you that they've foiled thousands and thousands of these attacks on World of Warcraft by doing what they do. And as a matter of fact, there are so many federal agents in World of Warcraft that they have to have minders that have organized basically these teams. They have a special term for it. It's actually in my column. I couldn't even remember it. It was such an absurd technical term, what was it called? Something like deconvergence or something like that, where these teams, their entire job is to make sure that all of these spies and agents don't wind up spying and inhibiting each other in the game. Because the majority of people who are like you and I can't afford to be on World of Warcraft 24 hours a day because we're trying to earn enough money to put food in our mouths. So the only people who can play World of Warcraft during working hours, during bankers' hours, during government hours, which is basically – government hours, by the way, are basically 10 a.m. till about 11 a.m. They work for 1 hour, and then what happens is after that they have 1 hour before lunch and 1 hour after lunch. They take 3 hour lunches. I'm not exaggerating. And these are like 6-7 martini lunches. And then they come back pig face drunk. And the remainder of the day, which is basically from about 2 p.m. till 4 p.m. Because, by the way, I don't know if you're aware of this, but everybody should be. Governments, state or federal, they close at 4 p.m. There's no way that any of them stay till 5 p.m. They close at 4 p.m. So between about 2 to 4 p.m., that's about 2 hours. So they work about 3 hours a day, and they don't work Fridays. Guaranteed. They don't work Fridays. Guaranteed. They don't even show up for work. So you've
got – what a luxury.
Yeah, and all the time that they're there, that 3 hours a day that they're there, 4 days a week, they play World of Warcraft. And that is essentially the only people who you will find online when you go on World of Warcraft during banker's hours. You know that the vast majority of people that you're dealing with are government agents. And that is how the situation is. And they've officially admitted that, and they say that they're doing this, they're foiling terrorists. When it gets to that point where they're telling you that, I don't understand why the taxpaying electorate just doesn't – I mean, it's no wonder that you're going to become the Eloi. I mean, you deserve to be eaten. This is literally at this point. I really don't know how to express it. But anyhow, but what the government is also preparing you for is the great dislocation where they won't be there for you. Now, your U.S. government continually tells you, you know, during an earthquake, during a hurricane, during any major event, a tornado, all the rest of this, they want you to be prepared. So they're actually telling you to stock up on food, stock up on supplies. They're not saying ammunition now. They'll try and deprive you of that. But they're telling you, make sure that you have a bug out bag. Make sure you have all this. Now, why are they telling you this? The reason they continually emphasize survivalism, the zombie worst case scenario, one of the major reasons they're emphasizing it, is they are telling you they are not going to be there. Basically, this is their equivalent of saying, ladies and gentlemen, you're on your own. Good night.
Why shouldn't we prepare for that type of scenario? I mean, shouldn't we do something if we can to prepare ourselves for such a apocalyptic scenario?
I understand that to be a valid argument. At the same time, look at the reality of it. The reality of it is how self-sustaining can you be? The reality is no man is an island, and you require an entire community to go with you. Basically, you're talking about joining a cult.
You think a community approach is a better one?
Well, obviously, the community approach is a better one.
If you can get people on board, though, it seems like a tougher row to hoe.
Yeah, but that's the point. You can't. Unless you're joining some apocalyptic cult, you are not going to be able to get a community together. I mean, what are you going to need to get a truly viable community? Hey, you're going to need a doctor. You're going to need some nurses. You're going to need any number of other people that you've never thought of before. For one thing, how are you going to farm? Okay, none of us know how to farm, so we're all going to die when our stocks run out.
Farming's a natural thing, though, man. You plant the seeds and, nature let nature take its course, kind of.
That's not serious. That's not a serious statement, is it? You can't possibly be serious. No, I mean, please.
It's more complex than that?
Yeah, this is obviously a gentleman who has never farmed before.
Anything legal.
I was born in China, by the way, and I appreciate the nothing legal joke, by the way. That's a good one. I like that. We have entire pot farms, of course, in people's apartments here in San Francisco where I live.
You're preaching to the choir, man.
Yeah. So the hydroponics, the hydroponic approach, by the way, is doable. It is workable. It is viable.
I hear you.
And so that is a wave of the future after billions die off first. But the reality is, of course, that again, to go to the China analogy, I was born in China, and I was born in the Nationalist Republic, which had relocated to the island of Taiwan. That's commonly known about anyone who investigates my background. Now, the reason it relocated to the island of Taiwan was because it had lost an incredibly apocalyptic civil war with the communists, who overswept the mainland. One of the reasons that the communists won was because the Chinese Civil War, in its most cynical, shall we say, interpretation, its most cynical filtration, was literally urban gangsters, who were the nationalists, who were the capitalists, versus rural bandits, who were the communists, who were the peasants. Now, China had been an agrarian society for countless thousands of years. So 90%, well over 90%, literally statistically, I would be safe to say around 97 to 99% of the population were rural peasants. So it was inevitable in terms of sheer numbers that the communists would win when they became the rural bandits who rallied the peasantry. Now, the small amount of people who lived in the cities were totally dependent on riverine supply. So whoever dominated the rivers became the dominator of the economy and logistics of China because all the food was transported by the rivers, all the supplies, that was inland. Aside from the inland, you get to the coast, and overwhelmingly China's economy is based on the coast. So these were coastal cities that were supplied by boats and shipping from the outside. Ultimately, they all evacuated to a large island. There are about 100 islands in the Taiwan Island group, but one main island that I was born on in its capital, the city of Taipei. So ultimately, they had to retreat to an island nation and form what became known as Island China to escape the communism. Now, the United States is just the opposite. To show you how insane the situation is here, it's like reality turned on its head, like a pyramid set on its top. It is basically a situation where it's just the opposite. You have 99% of the population functionally living in the cities, and less than 1%, something like 0.5% of the population, is farming. And almost all of that farming is dominated by agribusiness, by major corporations who hire illegal immigrants to do the picking. So if they did not bring the illegal immigrants up by the tens, if not hundreds of thousands, to the United States to pick those crops would wither on the vine, quite literally, and die. And the reason why is because they have no machinery to pick it up. Now, I personally knew somebody who had a double major in both artificial intelligence and electronic engineering. And his thesis, his master's degree thesis, was one about artificial intelligence to design to work automated assembly systems. In other words, self-aware automated assembly systems. Now, no one would hire him because no one in the United States needed that. They said, "Why do we need that when we don't build things anymore? The United States has no industrial base. So go to hell." And so he approached agribusiness and he said, "Oh, I can make picking machines that could literally pick." Machines, you know, pick on all the fruit, and you won't need these illegal immigrants. They said, "Why would we do that? You know, we spend so little. Why would we invest in these incredibly expensive self-aware picking machines, these robots when we can just hire all these illegal immigrants for pennies on the dollar? Go to hell." Now, he lives basically in the home in a combat zone in the middle of some destitute area of Ohio, basically off of peanut butter and cans of beans in this home he inherited from his grandparents. He was taken of until they died, and he may as well be dead. I mean, he's unemployable. No one will hire him, and all that education meant jack shit. So this brings us back to the question: since they have no machines to pick that amount of fruit, and if they illegal migrant labor dried up because there was no economy to sustain it, and there was no point in them coming up here. No one's there to pick the food, let alone distribute it, and everybody starves. So we are in a situation where when our society collapses, this is what I mean by the elevator hitting the bottom of the shaft, it collapses all at once. And there's no way you and I can go out there and say, "Well, let's farm ourselves," because we would never be able to farm enough to sustain one person, let alone thousands of people.
So, yeah, I agree with you, Douglas, that a big issue in the post-collapse is going to be food. And so what's interesting on things like Hunger Games or like zombie apocalypse-themed material like The Walking Dead is a wildly popular show. On The Walking Dead, they explore this idea where the group says, "Well, surely the government is still up and running. Surely the Center for Disease Control will have figured a solution," and they go explore it. And of course, there's no government. There's no nothing left. They were never even there. It was all a big show to begin with. So yeah. As soon as the collapse happens, they're gone. They're out the door. But yeah. In the show, they glorify guns. They always, every single episode, it's about guns, guns, guns. That's how you survive in the post-apocalyptic world. But they rarely talk about food, which I think would be a much more primary concern.
Absolutely. And the people who store up on a lot of food, then the problem is, even though you've got preserves or meals ready to eat, some kind of prepared foods that are dehydrated, desiccated, whatever, that last for long periods of time, eventually, of course, it's going to run out. Eventually, of course, unless you're just a total hermit, you are going to be sharing it. And the end result is, of course, it's also a target. That brings us back to the food and the raising of food. Who are the only sustenance farmers in the world today? Basically, people who would have been termed in periods of time a religious cult. And that would be the Mennonites, the Amish, the Pennsylvania Dutch, various highly religious peoples that take their religion so seriously that all they do all their lives is farm. And their problem, and it is a problem, is they are pathologically pacifist. There is such a thing as too much of a good thing. Now, it's one thing for someone to say, I'm going to sublimate all of my sexuality and violence and become a Buddhist monk. And you've got a whole community of people like that. And even in China, where they had thousands of years of culture, they dealt with bandits, they dealt with warlords, the phenomenon of warlordism. They dealt with civil war, internecine conflict for centuries at a time. These Buddhist monks became Shaolin monks. They became martial arts monks because they weren't going to go down without a fight. They learned that you are not going to live as a pacifist unless you are willing to kill and die for your pacifism. And there, in reality, is no pacifism in any other way unless you just lie down and die, which is kind of the apathy the government is preparing you for.
There's 99 apocalyptic problems, man.
Yes, and that brings us back to why the zombie meme. Why is the zombie meme so important? Why is it so obsessive? Why is the government shoving it down your throat? Now, anyone who thinks the government is not pushing the zombie memetic is sorely misguided. They are truly naive. Because it has been the CDC, it has been the Department of Defense, it has been the Surgeon General, it has been the people involved with Fort Detrick that have put forward campaigns and ads you can find on YouTube, which are government officially approved, talking about the zombie apocalypse. Now, I'm sure that both of you gentlemen are familiar with that.
Yes, here in San Diego, they actually had some military drills where they actually were apocalypse zombie attack drills, and people thought it was highly suspicious and weird why they would be preparing for that. And we know about the way drills coordinate with real events. We've seen it before.
Yes, absolutely. And so we do want to very much emphasize that when the government, which may not be in any way, shape, or form omniscient or even functional, the one thing that you can get from the government is when they're not outright propagandizing you, when they're coming at you from an almost nuanced fashion, which even though the zombie meme is hardly nuanced, it is something that basically is pumped and pumped relentlessly pretty much 24 hours a day. Why would they be doing that? Because for them, that's a bit more subtle than the government message campaigns that they usually throw out. And the reason why is because, of course, zombies are quite real. Now, they've known of this for quite some time. And, of course, they've been dealing with the reality of it for quite some time in terms of trying to manufacture zombies.
Really?
Yes. And that, of course, the question would be why and all the rest of that. So that brings us to the reality of zombies from a number of different levels. Now, the traditional zombie, the Haitian zombie, which I don't want to overdwell on, and or the prion zombie, which I don't want to really overdwell on. The question ultimately for this discussion is why? Why are they banking on the dead? Why are they investing in the Walking Dead? Why are they concerned about the fact that the Walking Dead might go out of control? Why are they buying all of the ammunition, which is meant specifically to take out zombies, which is, of course, the expanding bullet, the soft tip expanding shell ammo is that which they prize the most. They have been buying all of that up to basically take out hordes of bodily people. That is anti-personnel. By that I mean it's totally anti-physical body ammunition. The kind of expanding bullet with the soft tip that blows somebody apart doesn't work against a car. It's not meant to take out automobiles. You have other kinds of ammo for that. So you can't really effectively go through a car door as efficiently with something like that as you can with other types of shells. Well, they're investing in all of this because of several things that they've dealt with in the past. Now, one of them, the traditional Haitian zombie, comes, of course, from the Pudzombie, the zombie formula, which has been used to manufacture zombies in the island of Haiti and throughout Latin America for centuries. And this, of course, is to the extent where Article 246 of the 1835 Código Penal de Haiti, meaning the Haitian Penal Code, still in force today, renders it illegal to manufacture a zombie. It shall be qualified as attempted murder, the employment which may be made against any person of substances which, without causing death, produce a lethargic coma or less prolonged. If after administering such substances the person has been buried, the act shall be considered as murder no matter what result follows, meaning whether they get up and walk or not. Now, again, this was written in 1835, and it has very modern terminology, so it actually anticipated what we are going to be dealing with. Now, this is what made Dr. Wade Davis, the ethnobotanist of the movie Serpent in the Rainbow, this is what makes him an international criminal. He's basically a drug dealer. Because he was requested to come down to Haiti by Dr. Nathan Klein. Dr. Nathan Klein was someone who had an unsurpassed reputation. He basically had been working in Haiti for many years. If I'm not mistaken, he was working there the majority of his life, something like 20 to 30 years. And he had worked with zombies, the most famous case being that of Clarvius Narcisse, last name, appropriately enough, spelled like narcissism. Now, Dr. Nathan Klein was a psychopharmacologist, and he was the only two-time winner of the Albert Lasker Award for Clinical Medical Research. That's an award that's known as America's Nobel Prize. Now, he had, with Dr. Manfred Kleins, who had coined the term cyborg back in 1960, first using the phrase in an article published in Astronautics magazine about the advantages of self-regulating humanic machine systems in outer space. Been working with Dr. Nathan Klein for 30 years. And both of them have very similar names. One is spelled K-L-I-N-E. The other man, Manfred Klein's, his last name is spelled C-L-Y-N-E-S. They are not related. But at any rate, while they were working there, the entire idea was to find the secrets of Pudzombie, or the Haitian zombie powder, to apply in astronauts so that they could kill them and reanimate them at the other end of their trip.
Wow.
This way you could actually have somebody who would go into a legal and clinical state of death. Now think about what I'm saying. Take that literally. A legal and clinical state of death, as real zombies do, that are manufactured in Haiti, and be reanimated at the end of their voyage and actually function, because they would not be subjected to the same procedure which turns the zombies into a volitionless automaton as they are used for in Haiti and in Latin America, basically as slaves. Now, when you are able to put someone under and bring them back as a functional, volitional human being, you've got a great tool to use for space exploration. You could conceivably send someone out on trips to the other end of the solar system with conventional rocketry the size of what Dr. Werner von Braun designed for the moon landings, the Atlas rockets, could theoretically take you all the way to Pluto. It would just take years and years and years, decades. So you could have somebody reanimate after those decades and function as an astronaut, go into death again, and come home. And that is what they were thinking of. That is what the term cyborg was originally co-opted for in terms of humanic machine systems that are self-regulating in outer space, because they would, of course, be regulated by monitoring by machines that would not need to be pumping fluids into them or pumping out secretions, because they would neither be breathing nor eating nor secreting, because they would be legally and clinically dead. So that would save all of the money that you would otherwise have for all that liquid soup and pumping out all that liquid shit. Right. So you've got this situation that was perfect. So they brought down Dr. Wade Davis to become a drug dealer and buy the Pood Zombie. Now, they couldn't do it because they were legal doctors, and if they pursued that research, they would be arrested and expelled. So they brought down Dr. Wade Davis, the adventurer, specifically as an ethnobotanist to take that risk. And he was willing to take it, and he purchased an enormous amount of Pood Zombie, smuggled it out of Haiti to the sponsors of both clients, Dr. Klein and Dr. Klein's. And he brought it back to the as-yet unnamed pharmacological industries. Now, in terms of these sponsors, in the film The Serpent and the Rainbow, they give a false name, a cover name, Boston Biocorp. Now, Boston Biocorp is representative of these real sponsors that sponsored Wade Davis to go down there at the behest of the Kleinses. And Wade Davis never identified who his sponsors were. Now, he brought back the Pood Zombie to them. And what was the public justification? Because the public knew about it through the movie Serpent and the Rainbow and the book he wrote, which made his name a household name in anthropology. So what was the justification? The rationalization was, of course, anesthetic shock. It's important to remember that the pharmaceuticals industry is $300 billion a year. And $300 billion United States dollars a year pretty much makes them run the government. This is why your schools promote Ritalin. This is why they pump your kids full of drugs. This is why everywhere you go, everybody's on prescription psychotropics, etc. Mm-hmm. Now, they were justifying what they were doing for good cause because 20,000 people a year die of anesthetic shock. Now, we can go into the reasons for that. And the problem is nobody needs to die of anesthetic shock. But the reality is 20,000 people do. They said that they were pursuing the Pood Zombie because the miracle of the Pood Zombie is that the people who are put under not only are clinically and legally dead, you can bring them back. And they don't die.
Crazy, man.
They could die after that if you shoot them, but they don't die through the process.
Yeah.
So they could conceivably use this on anyone to put them out in such a way that the anesthesiologist would no longer need to monitor you with the enormous risk that they monitor you with in surgery. You could pretty much cut a person up and put them back together again and not worry about anything.
Legal loophole.
But they didn't do that. They didn't apply to that. 20,000 people a year still die from anesthetic shock. So what did they do with it? Well, they put it into research concerning slave labor. Okay, now slavery is illegal in the United States, correct?
Well, so they say.
Well, it is illegal if you're alive. Now, that was the whole reason for Terry Shiver Schindler. Excuse me, Terry Schindler Shiver. What was her name again?
Terry Schiavo?
Terry Schiavo. Thank you. Yes, and she had a Schindler in there somewhere, I believe. She was of half Jewish descent, if I remember correctly. At any rate, Terry Schiavo was married to a paramedic. I don't know if you're aware of this. He was an emergency medical technician who had claimed that he had converted to Buddhism. He makes a big deal about that. By the way, he's about as Buddhist as Anton LaVey was a good Christian or something like that. So this individual basically got a hold of Pood Zombie. He actually used it on Terry Schiavo. And that is something that is pretty much known in paramedical circles.
Wow.
Now, this is not an accusation because I don't want a lawsuit, but this is something that is circulated in paramedical circles that is pretty much taken for granted because she had all the symptoms. Now, because he was not an expert, because he was not somebody who was a Bokor or a Vajahudunista, a Vajahuduns or voodoo practitioner, he did not apply it correctly. And instead of putting her into a legally, clinically dead state where she would have been buried alive, and would ultimately conceivably have suffocated. Conceivably, I'm saying, because she would not have been breathing. People who are underneath this influence of Kudzombi do not breathe. So conceivably, somebody could last for years, theoretically, being buried and be exhumed years or maybe decades later and still be alive if you reanimate them, theoretically. Now, I don't know if anyone's ever done that, but if they have, it hasn't been recorded. And one of the reasons why is because, again, the legality issue in the places where people are much more aware of this phenomena. Now, in his case, he pretty much put her into a coma where she was barely functional. And ultimately, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it was put into the hands of the governor of the state, who was Jeb Bush, George Bush Jr.'s brother, the son of George W. Bush Sr., and also the man who George Bush actually expected to become president, as opposed to the retard. Now, to give you some background on just how maniacal or how manipulative or evil Jeb Bush is, Jeb Bush was running for governor in one of the most important swing states. That's how he made his brother president. Now, he was running for governor, and the way that he won was he converted to Catholicism. He converted to Catholicism so he would impress all the Cubano emigres from communist Cuba who were ardent Catholics. Not only did he convert to Catholicism, he married a Latina. She is known as the Dark One.
He had
several children with her and then divorced her as soon as he became governor. She now lives in a massive hacienda estate in Mexico with the kids and is paid an enormous amount of money to keep quiet and never come home with the children. And that's the kind of individual that Jeb Bush is. Now, all this got thrown in his lap, and he had the opportunity to provide a gubernatorial pardon for the death sentence on Terry Schindler Schiavo, and he basically killed her. He said, go ahead and kill her. Now, why is this so important other than moral outrage? The reason that this is important is because that was the legal precedent for anyone who is clinically termed brain dead. Now, keep in mind, Terry Schindler Schiavo was not legally and clinically dead. She was termed vegetative state. And that meant, by the way, that she was fully conscious of everything that was going on around her. To give you an example of this, you have a situation that was dealt with by this man who was in Europe. And this man was, incident to a car accident, thrown into a vegetative state.
Right.
And his parents kept saying that the doctors kept telling his parents to kill him and put him out of his misery. And his parents refused to do so. Now, there was an MD who finally used highly advanced medical sensing equipment that did not exist until literally a few years ago. And he was able to prove that this man was responding to all of his stimulations, meaning that this man was entirely conscious of everything that was going on around him, meaning that he could hear every word the doctor said when the doctors were telling his parents to kill him.
Wow.
For 10 years. And the individual in question, I'll have to look through my notes exactly to find out who that is. By the way, it's something that people can search engine if I do not find that. But in terms of what I am bringing up, the reason it is so important is that essentially proves what Terry Schindler Schiavo was going through. She was utterly conscious of the fact that they were going to kill her. And that is because her nurses reported her real name, by the way, was Theresa Marie Schindler. That was it. And Schiavo was the last name of the scumbag who she married. And so she collapsed into a vegetative state due to supposedly oxygen deprivation in 1990. And they basically thanatized her by her husband's wishes through torture. They dehydrated her to death. They pulled out her water, so that her body slowly shriveled up and died. Now, the important thing about pulling the plug was that the man who was originally, that I was bringing up in Europe, that was suffering that exact same condition, was a man who named Ram Haubin, R-O-M was his first name. His family name was H-O-U-B-E-N. He was born in 1963, so he's about the same age as my late sister would be if she were still alive. I was born in 66, so he's about 50 now, about half a century old. The doctor who saved his life was Stephen Lowries, a neurologist, L-A-U-R-E-Y-S. And it was Dr. Stephen Lowries who used – he's a neurologist. He used ultra-modern imaging technology to prove that this person was able to hear and see and feel everything but nevertheless could not respond. That's exactly how Shivo was. Now, get what I'm saying. That means that they were functional. That means that if you could do something with the bodies to tweak it just right, they could ambulate.
Slave labor.
That means that – yes.
Put them on the assembly line.
Yes, and what makes all of this so important is that the United States government, by what they did through Jeb Bush with Shivo, was that is the legal precedent for slavery in the United States. Anyone who is considered brain dead by your medical industrial complex can be used as slave labor. The reason why is because you can kill them. If you can kill them, you could do anything with them. So back to what we were speaking of with what your government is working with.
Sure.
Biological researchers have gone well beyond using Pood Zombie, the zombie powder that was retrieved by the ethnobotanist Wade Davis, by actually creating zombie cells in the lab which outperform living cells. Now, Sandia National Laboratories and the University of New Mexico have innovated a technique whereby mammalian cells are coated with silica to form near-perfect replicas. Now, these replicate cells, they're called silica replicates. They can survive greater pressures and temperatures than flesh, and they can perform many functions better than the original cells did when they were alive. Now, by painting the cells with silicic acid in a petri dish, the acid embalms the organic matter in the cell right down to the nanometer level, right down to the nano level of engineering. Now, the silica acts as a permeable armor. Now, all of this was publicly admitted by Michael Hess at the American Office of Public Affairs. This is your U.S. government talking, not myself. That means that the cell beneath can be used as a catalyst at far greater temperatures than normal. That means that the human body that has been treated thus is bulletproof. It would be like a zombie who is reanimated, having been buried for many years near an asbestos factory.
Hmm.
Now, heating the silica to around 400 degrees centigrade evaporates all of the protein in the cell, but it leaves the silica as a three-dimensional replica of the formerly living being. Now, the reason that this is so important is they found a way to destroy protein, which is, of course, the prion, the main source of rabid or feral zombies. Prion is an acronym for protonaceous infectious ion. That is what turns a zombie, which is a volitionist Haitian kind of ambulatory machine, which is spelled Z-O-M-B-I, it attacks that E at the end and turns it into the zombie with an E that we all know and love through video games and movies that eats everybody, like a shark sniffing blood, going after everything around it. Now, this biological material that's been created can be converted into a reusable fossil, which could have uses in fuel cells, decontamination, sensor technology, commercial manufacturing. And the lead researcher's name is Brian Kaehr, K-A-E-H-R. And he's issued public statements that distinguishes these silicate replicates, these silicate replicate cells. They distinguish them between mummy cells and zombie cells. So he calls what they're creating zombie cells. They bridge chemistry and biology to create forms that not only nearly perfectly resemble their past selves, but actually outperform them. They can
Creepy.
Do future work. Do you understand what I'm saying? He said they can do future work.
Wow.
So that means
that's creepy,
the hardened silica-based cells display internal mineralized structures with intricate features ranging from nano to millimeter length scales. So you'll be dealing with scaled, fireproof zombies. And the result is, why are they dealing with this? Why are they all moving underground? One of the reasons is the threat of course, the Yellowstone volcano. They do expect that to go at some time. That is inevitable. They don't know when.
Uh-oh.
When that goes, the entire world around us changes. Also, we're undergoing enormous atmospheric changes that they think is going to make a great deal of our atmosphere highly flammable. Now, that might take a while to go into. If we don't have time for that today, we could do that in another interview as well. But our elites, the people who essentially run your nation and through its empire functionally at the moment, however ineffectively and however self-destructively they run the world, even though it is in passing, even though it's transitional, at the moment we have an ultra power as opposed to a superpower, the sole superpower, the American empire. Now, these people who run your American empire are convinced we are going to enter a state of anoxic oceans, oceans without without oxygen, and we are going to enter also a highly flammable methane-filled atmosphere, which giant clouds of methane released from under the sea as they're being released right now, which are causing dead zones all over the world in the world's oceans. They feel that this is going to lead to another mass extinction. Now, the last mass extinction, by the way, was well over a 90% die-off. 97% of all life on Earth died 200 million years ago. 90% of all species were wiped out. They expect that we're going through that again now, and they're banking on the dead. They're going to stay underground, and while the atmosphere is flaming overhead and the oceans become stagnant pools of oxygenless water, they're going to have a labor force on the surface that will not burn and will not breathe.
Wow. Well, that is amazing stuff. You gave us some really great things to look forward to in 2014. Great way to close out the year of 2013. Positive things all around. Double rainbow all the way across the sky.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. So that's about our time, man. The hour goes by so quickly. Thanks for taking the time to do the show. Do you want to tell the people what you're up to next, where they can keep up with you? Are you making any appearances? What are you working on? Stuff like that?
We're working on a lot. Most of that is in the hands of my adult supervisor, my manageress, Lorian Ann Fenton. Do contact her, anyone who wants to set up any presentations or any interviews or anything at all. Contact her at Lorian@douglasteacher.com. You'll find her email link, as well as what you can order to support me in the meantime until my books come out. And that will be at www.douglasdietrich.com, along with whatever updated schedule she's eventually going to put up there sometime in the near future. And right now, I've been pretty much plastered with the December month because it was the Pearl Harbor anniversary month. So I've been pretty much doing a lot of interviews concerning that. And we'll be happy to do an interview with you concerning the war sometime. That will be inescapable to touch on when we do talk about the alien invasion scenario, which they are continually pushing down your throats. So I want to thank both of you for having me and very much appreciate your listenership. And I do beg you, of course, to send me a link to the program whenever you get the audio.
Of course, of course. Solid, my friend. So there it is, people. You know, look up Douglas Dietrich if you want to have him on your show. He's down for bar mitzvahs, weddings, birthdays, the whole gamut.
Yeah, that's right. I also play Count, what is it? The Count from Sesame Street, since I look just like him. I play that at kids' parties, but I hate doing that because I hate kids. Anyway.
All right. Well, solid, my friend. We know what to look out for. Keep fighting the good fight, Douglas, and we'll talk to you in the future if we're allowed.
Yes. Look forward to it. You're the best.
All right,
and
man.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow, man, amazing stuff. Any thoughts on that, the zombie apocalypse?
It's really weird, you know, both the predictive programming and television content and also all this information he's bringing forward about actual real zombies. And I don't know, man.
And the legal precedent. The Terry Schiavo legal precedent for zombieization, that was pretty intense because they do have a tendency to do that, you know, even pushing forth the NDAA, they set the legal precedent, and then we see it roll out a few years later. The Patriot Act, another good example.
It's a crazy landscape, the way Douglas describes it, and it seems as though he thinks both not doing anything or doing something to prepare for the inevitable collapse, both routes are ultimately futile. And right. The one piece of good advice I believe he said was that community will be important, which I can definitely back that up.
Yeah, it's a great show. I think everybody is really going to need to study that and prepare for what's next.
Dan Harmon.
Anyway, this is going to be the last episode of 2013. I wanted to make sure you co-hosted this with me because you've helped out a lot along the way. We've tried a few shows before THC, and now I really think the Higher Side Chats has made its mark, and I wanted to say thanks for your involvement, man.
Oh, it's been an excellent road, and I get so excited by being a part of it, and I love seeing it grow, and I love seeing the audience enjoy it. And I think your intros are totally the best in the game. Mm-hmm. Talking about the best in the podcast game. So concise, man.
Well, thanks. I mean, looking back at the year, at some of the guests we've had, you think we've done pretty good? What's your fiscal analysis if you were presenting this to the board?
I would say that it's very clear we have a career of talking with intelligent, informed, on a variety of topics, politically engaged individuals who have done a hell of a lot of research in so many different fields. And we have gone through, we have sifted much information that has been brought forward. And I don't know where we stand, but I can guarantee that shit is a lot more mixed up than most people think. And once you start going down the rabbit hole, it is just does it ever end? Can it end?
No.
It just keeps on going.
Well, we are on an upward trajectory for sure. I feel like it's been an excellent year for THC. I love it, man. It's been a blast. My next 10 shows, we have some huge guests starting the year off in January. And I don't want to say who yet on the air. I want it to be a surprise. Yeah. I like that about THC, that you never know like what the episode's going to be about. It's just like, boom, there it is. It's about some random shit. And it's unpredictable. But I'm very pleased that in this early 2014 lineup, you're going to see some power players. You know a few of them. Are you pretty pumped?
I cannot give the spoiler, let it be an Easter egg, but I'm most psyched. I couldn't be more psyched. I mean, for at least several people you mentioned, it's going to be so great.
Nice. Well, cool. Well, Merry Christmas. Do what you can to avoid the zombie apocalypse. We'll see you in 2014. That's it for us, people. Thanks for all the support this year. We'll see you. Don't forget about the THC Money Bomb. Donate if you can. Peace.
Peace.